You may recall a big debate around universal pre-K going into the mayoral primary in Kansas City, Missouri last month. Now that the dust has settled, in the sense that we know how that turned out, we want to get the lay of the land, not just for pre-K, but for early childhood education and daycare more broadly. Because until your kids turn five, there really isn't a public option. You've got to figure out a way to both support your kids financially and raise them, keep them safe, teach them things. That's not just expensive. Childcare is hard to find, period. If you've never looked for childcare as a working parent, let me give you a taste of what those phone calls tend to sound like.
Right now, we are completely full for infants. We actually are not even taking any more on the wait list because the wait list is so lengthy.
So, yeah, let's talk about that. On KCUR's Central Standard, I'm Gina Kaufman, and we'll start by getting some national perspective with Katie Hamm. She's Vice President for Early Childhood Policy for the Center for American Progress, where she worked on a study of America's childcare deserts in 2018. Hi, Katie.
Hi.
That phone call I recorded probably doesn't surprise you.
No, not at all, unfortunately, especially for infants.
How would you define the term childcare desert?
So with our study, we used a definition by looking at census tracts. And if there are not enough licensed childcare slots in that census tract to serve at least one-third of the children under 5 years old, then we designate that as a child care center. And that one-third measurement is based on nationally about how many families are using licensed child care.
But if there's not enough child care, is measuring how many are currently using it the way to evaluate, like, adequate supply?
You know, it's a difficult thing to measure because there are a lot of different things going on here. Some parents have family nearby. Some families are not in the workforce. They have a stay-at-home parent. So we use kind of the national trend as a measure. It certainly is an imperfect measure, but we're looking, when we call something a child care desert, it means there's a significant undersupply. It's a pretty conservative measurement. I think you're right that there are probably more child care deserts out there than our research can even pick up on.
What are the big takeaways from your national study?
So overall, about half of Americans live in a child care desert, and it is most acute in rural areas, which is probably not surprising. Where the population is more dispersed, there's kind of less resources and infrastructure overall, so we see higher rates in rural areas. We also see higher rates of childcare deserts in neighborhoods with higher proportions of Hispanic or Latino families. And, you know, we kind of contextualize this in our study and define this as a financing issue. So as you alluded to earlier, there's very, very little public support for families who have trouble paying for childcare. We do have some federal and state funding. It's enough to serve about 1 in 6 eligible families, just those who are eligible. You have a 1 in 6 chance of getting that help. And so we largely see childcare deserts emerge where families don't have the resources to pay for childcare. And so we see a correlation between income and child care deserts is pretty strong throughout the country.
People talk about this problem from so many different angles, one being the availability of good education for the purpose of what they call kindergarten readiness. And that's what Kansas City's pre-K debate seemed to center around for the most part. But there are other issues: affordability, the number of spots in classrooms not matching the number of kids who need care, which is the one you've been talking about. Mm-hmm. And then the proximity of care for parents with limited time for long commutes.
Right. So when you look at what drives child care decisions, especially for low-income families, it's primarily cost and location. And we know that licensed child care is very expensive. In both Kansas and Missouri, it's about $10,000 a year to send your child to a center. But what we haven't talked about as much is if you have to get on a bus or two buses to get to that child care center, or if you don't have a reliable vehicle, that's another barrier that families can face. you know, in many ways, childcare and early education is kind of a win-win because you can support parents' access to employment, families' financial stability. And as you said, you can also support children's learning. And that isn't that doesn't start at five. It doesn't even start at three or four. It starts when children are very young. So in making these investments, we can kind of get the benefit of for both parents and children.
Can you explain economically why there aren't enough spots for all the kids who need care? It's something that you would think supply and demand would take care of, but I understand that it does not.
Yeah, you know, I think it comes down to childcare being a really costly business. So when you think about what high quality childcare looks like small adult to child ratios. So having, you know, one early educator who's caring for three babies rather than four or five, which means not all the babies' needs are being met. So if you think about, you know, other industries, you can gain efficiencies. By definition, providing high quality childcare is expensive.
And inefficient, honestly. Like, there's nothing efficient about caring for a baby.
Right. And so you have most childcare providers, whether it's a family childcare home or a childcare center, they're operating on a really thin margin. The only way they can, the only revenue they have for the most part is through parent tuition payments. And so they can only open their doors if they're in a community where most parents can afford that $10,000 a year. And that still means, you know, when you think about if one provider is caring for three babies and they're all paying about $10,000 a year, that's $30,000 that they have to pay that provider. They have to keep the lights on, pay the rent, equipment, food. It doesn't add up. And that's why we argue that you need a public investment to offset some of those costs and the parent payments.
I want to read a quote from an article in the New Republic. In 2016, the article says nearly 2 million parents with kids age 5 and younger had to quit, turn down a job, or significantly change their work because of childcare problems. Women are often the hardest hit since the 1980s as childcare costs have climbed 70%, working mothers' labor force participation rate has declined 13%.
Mm-hmm.
Discuss.
Yeah, I mean, there's such a clear link, and there's mounting evidence that childcare and help paying for childcare, help finding childcare, has a pretty significant effect on maternal labor force participation. The Center for American Progress did a study here in DC where we have near universal preschool for 3 and 4 year olds, and we found that when DC implemented preschool, there was a 10 percentage point increase in maternal labor force participation. So the evidence on that is pretty undeniable. We've also looked at what happens when a parent has to leave the workforce because they can't find childcare. And what we found is that it's not just the lost wages, it's their earning potential over time, it's their retirement assets. So a parent who has to leave the labor force is going to feel the effect of that 5 or 7 or 10 years out of the labor force throughout their career. And it's probably going to cost them hundreds of thousands of dollars, not just that foregone income. So you have this, you have parents in this catch-22 where they can't afford to quit their job because they need it to pay their bills. They also can't afford to pay for childcare. And so they can't, they're stuck. They don't have any good options.
This issue has risen on people's radars, or it seems that way to me. We even have presidential candidates like Elizabeth Warren talking about it, based largely on her own life experience, but I'm guessing also a fair amount of political calculation. She and her team must think this is a big enough problem in enough Americans' lives that she'll get traction talking about it.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think, you know, for a long time, I think we were stuck in this ideology that this was a parent's responsibility. This was an individual problem. And as we've seen the brain development research that shows how important these first few years are in a children's life, as we've seen kind of the costs of childcare come to light and talked about it more in public forums, I think people are realizing that it's a pretty universal problem for parents, not just low-income parents. Middle-class families struggle with these costs as well. So I think we're seeing more and more traction. And Elizabeth Warren put out her universal childcare proposal. We also, just yesterday, Congress, with bipartisan support, is proposing more funding for childcare. Last year, they did the largest ever increase in what's called the Child Care and Development Block Grant. It funds states to provide child care assistance. It's been horribly underfunded for many, many years. And Congress is proposing another $2.4 billion for 2020. We still have to a while for that congressional process to work out. But we're seeing kind of bipartisan support that this is something that needs to change.
I want to bring a local voice in on this. Jovana Ross is director of early childhood education and Head Start at the Mid-America Regional Council, and she's done a study on this issue of availability of child care and how it relates to people's needs in Kansas and Missouri. Jovana, good morning.
Good morning.
Does this track with what you've seen here?
Absolutely. We really had started to see that there was concern among families as well as providers in the community and the workforce around where do people take their children for care when they're in the labor force.
What were your key findings?
We found that in our area, we have several deserts and mirror some of the national studies. So our urban core, we tend to see that we have some areas, as well as our first ring suburbs. We have in the northeast part of Kansas City, clear deserts where there aren't areas for children, which mirrors some of the Latino population findings found in the national study. Also South Kansas City, and then when you get into Wyandotte County as well. Not surprisingly, when you look in areas of Johnson County, and then really on some of the I-49 corridor on the Missouri side in Jackson County, we see more density of child care. So it mirrors really what the national findings.
This is something you've been watching for a while, right?
It is, yes.
What are your observations of, like, change over time?
It hasn't really changed, unfortunately. I think when Katie was talking about the cost of operating childcare, it's not really for the faint of heart. Whenever I hear somebody say we need more quality programs, let's build a place and ask somebody to come operate that program, I always really want to turn to those who have been successful rather than thinking about new comers to that business.
In the pre-K discussion here in town, one of the critiques of the mayor's plan was that in the first year, it would have accommodated only a fraction of the 4-year-olds in our city needing childcare. And the response to that critique was that there just aren't enough spots in existing programs, so the initial investment would have had to go to expanding those programs. Can you talk about the lack of spots available in daycare, in childcare, compared to the number of kids who need it? Because that is, like, a problem.
Absolutely. So in the state of Missouri, we really rely on Child Care Aware of Missouri and Kansas to provide us data on current licensed spots, as well as family child care businesses that are also operating. And what they have both found is that there's about 50% of the need being met. And how they measure that is through calls that they get for referral for programs. And so a family's calling, much like maybe what you had earlier, but maybe calling a referral center rather than the program itself, and asking about opportunities for those children. And so that 50% of the children that need care are not receiving that.
And I would think, based on the child to care provider ratios that are legally required, that this problem is more stark for the younger than pre-K set than for pre-K even.
Absolutely. Waiting lists for infants and toddlers are sometimes out the door. I mean, they can go on forever.
I want to say, I started making calls at 5 months pregnant. I had no idea that I was getting, we could get you off the waiting list in 2 years.
Right.
By then, I don't have an infant.
Correct. Right? And so that's how they can get you off, because in that time, they only have so many infants, but those rooms sometimes double in size when they become toddlers, and so they can take more children in. Some programs only take infants in when they're 9 months old, so maybe they wait a little bit longer. So if you deliver in January and they don't start until a September time, you're waiting that whole time. And then so families start to rely on each other to help each other out. But one barrier with that is if I go to a family child care provider, and I experience this myself with an infant, if that person is sick, there's no backup. If I go to a center, they typically would have a sub or somebody else to cover that classroom, and I can still go to work. But if I'm at a family child care provider, or I'm relying on a neighbor to take care of my child and they're sick, or their child is sick that's in care with them, I'm going to be missing that day of work, which then limits my productivity.
And then if you're an hourly worker, it also limits your income.
Absolutely. And I think that's the biggest piece that sometimes we forget in this, that if we aren't meeting the needs of families within that hourly workforce, we aren't really meeting the needs of all of our families. So, for example, if I'm a shift worker, try to find care that starts at 6 p.m. and goes until 6 a.m. There are a handful of programs that provide that care.
And more than a handful of people who need it, I'm assuming.
Absolutely. I think when Amazon was coming into their Kansas location, trying to answer that child care problem, it's still a conversation that's taking place.
There's a lot of talk of privilege when it comes to this discussion, and I think we've just touched on a lot of reasons why mm-hmm. that's a very valid part of the conversation. It is also, though, my perception that although it affects this like lack of options affects people of different economic backgrounds differently, it also does seem to be the case that anyone with a job, by necessity or by choice, does have to figure this out. So there is a universality to the program problem as well.
Absolutely. And so if you look at what's recommended nationally by Child Care Aware America of how much of your salary should go towards child care, it's about 10%. So I would need to make, if 9,000, and we did a cost of quality study recently, and $12,000 for the highest cost, for the highest quality of care,
that
is what we found.
A little more like what I've seen.
Right. So then we would have to then make at least $120,000 as a family in order to afford that care. Our median income in the Kansas City region is $63,000, and in the state, it's $53,000. So that's a huge gap. You know, we're looking at really 20%, 30% of income. And that's where that question of, do I stay in the workforce or do I leave?
Yeah,
and so,
we hear that there's been a 13% decline of women working moms in the workforce since the 70s? I mean, that's...
Right. And so I think all those points that Katie pointed out of the loss, not only of that company, of that valuable worker, but also of the earning potential, retirement potential moving forward. So even if you took the first 3 years, because it is a little bit, since the ratios are different, it's a little easier to find a 3, 4, or 5-year-old slot. If you take 3 years, then you're having to reacclimate to the workforce. You're going to have to figure out where do you fit back in to that workforce and then try to recoup those earnings over those times.
Katie, jump in.
Yeah, I would just echo, you know, what Giovanna said. I think, you know, the other thing we haven't quite talked about yet is the workforce. The people who provide this child care are paid so little.
Absolutely.
Nationally, the average wage is about $11 an hour. It's primarily women doing this work. You know, they are doing work that allows our entire economy to run because parents can then go to work. And they're
unless it's snowing.
Yes, exactly.
No, go on. Sorry.
No, that's okay. So, you know, it's squeezed. We're squeezed on all sides. Parents can't find the childcare. They're making difficult decisions. Workers are barely getting by. Many of them themselves live in poverty and struggle to put food on the table. Couldn't afford to send their own children to the programs where they work. So we've kind of, without investing in childcare and early education as a country, we've really created this situation that isn't working well for everyone. So I think, you know, we need to find a public solution that addresses these problems.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And in just a minute, we'll talk solutions. What's on the table now? Who's doing what for kids under 5 needing early childhood care and their parents who want to be able to give their kids the best while they're busy putting a roof over everyone's heads? Join the conversation with your story. 816-235-2888. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we're talking about childcare for really young kids, the high cost for families, the low pay for educators, the lack of spots for everyone, and the politics around all of that. Call 816-235-2888 with your stories and insights. My guests are Giovanna Ross of the Mid-America Regional Council and Katie Hamm of the Center for American Progress. Hi again, you two.
Hello.
Hi.
So I want to take a couple of calls before we get into the solutions piece of this, an important piece of it. But let's hear from Mandy in Raytown. Mandy's called 816-235-2888. Hi, Mandy.
Hi.
Tell your story.
I have a 3-month-old, and we started looking for childcare when I was 3 months pregnant, and we only found one place that was able to take him, and it is 30 minutes away from our home and where I work. So round trip each day, I spend 2 hours in the car getting him there and then getting back to work and then picking him up and getting home.
Which, so if you're really a working parent, that doesn't leave a lot of time for, like, the fun bonding part of parenthood.
Exactly. We get home, and it's time to give him a bath and feed him, and then it's time to go to bed. And it's really hard, especially because I had to go back to work after only 9 weeks. So just putting him in daycare was difficult, and then knowing how much of the day he's away from me is really difficult.
How do you cope?
Sometimes it's really difficult. You know, you just want to call in sick so that you can spend time with your kid. And that, you know, it's so hard.
Do you think differently about sort of the role of a public investment in all of this now that you're a parent yourself? I mean, has your feeling about the politics of all of this been affected by your personal experience?
I think I have always kind of leaned on the side of, like, public interest in helping others. But I think now that it affects me so personally, it's an even stronger issue for me.
Yeah. Well, Mandy, thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
We talked about the commute issue a little bit, but Katie, just nationally, the definition you provided of a child care desert does include, like, it's within a single census tract. So proximity is a part of how you measure that. But how do you ensure that there is a distribution, a geographic distribution of daycare?
Well, I think it goes back to something I said earlier, which is because we're kind of reliant on what parents can pay, we see child care programs generally clustered in areas where parents' incomes are high enough to pay the high tuition costs. And so you have areas where there's just not a lot of child care. And if you do have a parent who can't afford that, they're driving the 30 minutes like the caller mentioned. I think we need kind of a two-tiered solution where there's investment, but there's also some intentionality in looking at areas where there's not that infrastructure yet. I think Giovanna rightly pointed out that you can't just build a center and expect that somebody's going to come and operate it. You need that continued investment. But we have geographic coverage for programs like Head Start, for public schools in this country. There is no reason why, as a country, we can't look at the dispersion of childcare programs and make sure that families have something reasonably close to them.
Let's talk to Sasha in Kansas City. Hi, Sasha.
Hi. So my experience is a little different than some. So what I didn't realize when having my first child and putting them in childcare at 3 months old was that, you know, their immune systems aren't developed fully. And so when my daughter went into childcare, you know, I had exhausted my FMLA and my paid vacation at that point.
Because maternity leave, that's what that is. It's not just free time.
Right. And so I had exhausted all that just caring for her in the first 3 months of life. And then when she was about 4 months old, she actually caught RSV at the daycare that she was at. And so I was at this hard point where I could take off a little bit of time that had accrued because I came back to work. But after that point, like, she was in the hospital for about a week. And so I just didn't have vacation time left, and I had no more time for FMLA. So I ended up quitting my job because she got so sick.
Yeah. Sasha, I'm really sorry about hearing everything you've been through. Have you re-entered the workforce? Do you think you will re-enter the workforce? Are you happy to be out of the workforce, or sort of regretful that this was the direction things took?
So it was unfortunate that it happened so quickly, but what I've ended up doing is actually going back to school. And so now she's in a child care program at KU. She's at Hilltop, and I get a grant through my financial aid to pay for her child care now.
So that is an interesting story. Sasha, thank you so much for sharing your story. And Giovanna, I'd like you to talk about, contextualize the second piece of that story, especially that sounds like one thing that's happening locally, maybe, that I hadn't heard about.
Absolutely. And just recently, there was some federal dollars that were made available to universities and colleges to help to support their students while they're in school. And of course, that comes with the parameters of being in the workforce or work training program. The same is available on subsidies, both in Missouri and Kansas. But what we have to remember with subsidies is that it really only pays a minimal part of the cost. So in Kansas, the subsidy rate is below 50%, and sometimes it's as low as 19% of the cost. And so if you're thinking about families that are lower income, there's still a lot to make up. And so some of those child care development block grant dollars that Katie mentioned earlier this year in the Missouri side of the state line, they're really looking at how do we increase those subsidy rates, but still they're trying to get up to 75% of the market rate. So it's getting closer, but it's not quite where it needs to be. One initiative that's really interesting that's happening in Wyandotte County came about through a public-private partnership from the state of Kansas, from the Children's Cabinet. And really, it's called Start Young, and it's a variety of agencies that are coming together, but led by the Family Conservancy, to think about two prongs of solutions for this. One is increasing the capacity. So they are aiming to increase 300 high-quality slots or seats for children, birth to five. So really looking at that whole continuum. The other thing that they're trying to do is to build the capacity and strengths of the programs that are already in operation. And that's being done through professional development funds, as well as stipends for teachers as they increase their credential. Because as Katie said earlier, our workforce is grossly underpaid. And so imagine telling a teacher, you need to go back and get a degree, and it's going to cost you about $3,000 to $5,000 to maybe get your AA, and we'll give you a quarter raise when you get that. So if we think about how long does it take to make up that, it's going to take them a lot longer. And is it worth it? Is it worth going to school, doing all that extra work for a quarter? And so what Start Young is trying to do is how do we really incentivize the growth? And then how do we really level out what the base pay is? How do we move
beyond?
And they're
at the looking at that stage.
Right. Well, right now they're implementing. They're in their pilot year. It's a 3-year pilot. And what's innovative about it is it's some state money, but it's a one-to-one match with private money. So whether it's industry or foundations that are matching that, or the programs themselves saying, you know, I'm going to remodel, it's going to cost me $200,000, that's going to be my match to that piece. But I think that whole workforce piece is going to come a lot faster in Missouri as the minimum wage has increased. And by 2023, we need to get to $12 an hour. And so as Katie said, if the average is 11 and a quarter, we have some programs that are paying about $9 an hour. So where are you going to come up with that extra $3? But then you have Walmarts and Targets and big box stores that are paying a minimum of $11 to $12 an hour. So I can either go and stock shelves or be a cashier, or I can go and build brains for the same amount. And so how are we going to answer that when it comes to some of these issues? And I think that's something that we as a region still need to have conversations about.
So you aren't hearing suggestions for the answers to that piece of it yet?
Not that piece. I will tell you, as a Head Start grantee, we do not provide direct services, but we partner with 18 agencies that do. And we are sometimes fortunate to receive cost of living adjustments. And we brought partners together to talk about how do we raise our base pay, because we know we're going to face this and we have to get above that $12 an hour. So we've started that conversation, but it's difficult because we are only a part of their funding. We're not their total funding. And so if you are a program that serves children that are in Head Start, children that receive subsidies, and children that are parent pay, you have one funding stream that can help to increase salaries. But what do you do for the others that are in the program as well?
Right. And then it seems like the ability for the programs themselves to cut costs, that's sort of non-negotiable for most.
If you look at most budgets of any program, they're pretty close to the margin. They're really, you know, if whether they're not for
Even
profit
the good
or
programs.
Or a for profit. And really, some of the good programs are housed on the university campuses, and they have the benefit of having maybe not having to pay for their building or the grounds crews. But if I'm an independent provider, I have to mow the lawn. I have to make sure my building stays painted. I need to make sure it's safe for children to be there. And so really what families are looking for is number one, safety. You know, do I feel comfortable leaving my child there? The second thing that we found that families are looking for is curriculum. What are you doing with my child while they're there? You know, when they're infants and toddlers, I still want you to be building their brain because I know that 0 to 3 age range is so important. So relationships are key. So they want that. And then they also want convenience as well. But if you are a shift worker, as we talked earlier, and you have to line up the bus lines with where the program is and the hours, can I get to the bus at the time that I need to? It can be difficult.
Katie, when this innovative program going on in our area that we just heard about that is in the pilot stage, how does that fit into the different kinds of solutions being floated nationwide?
Yeah, you know, I think to solve this problem, we're going to kind of need both. We're going to need communities, regions, states coming together and figuring out what works for their community. What are kind of the unique contributions to the childcare crisis in their area? And I think we're also going to need federal solutions. You know, the federal government is in a much better position to pay for something like this than an individual state or community. So I think we're going to need both to figure this out. When I think about the kind of solution that we need, I think it has to do three things. One is to limit what families pay towards childcare, whether it's we usually use 7% of a family's income as the measure for affordability. It needs to address wages. So it needs to make sure that people who are working in childcare and early education settings are making a living wage. And that, as Giovanna mentioned, as they earn more credentials, experience, demonstrate competencies, they're getting paid more in a way that recognizes that skill. And then the last thing is quality. Providers want to be high quality childcare providers. They need resources to do that. A curriculum is not free. Training teachers on a curriculum is not free. All of that requires resources. And so there needs to be a financial investment in helping existing providers achieve higher levels of quality.
Giovanna, does the fact that the mayor's plan for pre-K was voted down change the conversation locally in a significant way, or is that not a significant change?
I don't think it's a significant change because I think that while that plan was targeted to four-year-olds, I think that the conversation, what we're doing now, is expanding to the whole range of birth to five, and that's super important because one of the things that we in the field talked about is we have to have a mixed delivery system because
what does that mean?
So you need to have a variety of different providers serving all ages, various ages of children. For example, if only school districts were to provide four-year-olds and you pull the four-year-olds out of community-based providers, the cost of infant toddler care is going to go up. Because since you can have more children in a pre-K classroom than you can have in an infant toddler, sometimes that helps to support the cost of the infant classrooms. And our cost of quality study showed the highest quality infant toddler, if it was standalone, would be about $24,000 a year.
Whew.
Right. And so if you take that $12 an hour, if you worked 40 hours a week, you would make a little over 24,000. And so you wouldn't want to be in the workforce if you had an infant.
No. Okay. So that's one piece of it. One thing that as a parent I was thinking about with the idea of this debate between a school district provided pre-K option and something that was just subsidized through a private provider. If you had not already been putting your kid in daycare and tried to take advantage of something at a private pre-K, but then had the intention of sending your kid to public school starting in kindergarten, going to a place for 1 year, although, I mean, a year is a pretty long time, but I think a lot of parents would prefer to not be sort of uprooting their kids in a program that quickly.
Sure, but I think some of the intention was that should a community-based provider be the one that is implementing that program, that they may have been there since birth. And so it offers that opportunity to not transition and to really provide continuity of care until the kindergarten transition. Because no matter if you're in a district, in a community-based school, in a charter school, in a family home, that transition is going to look same. So how do we limit the number of transitions? How do we have just one transition rather than two or three?
So then that gets back to the mixed delivery.
Absolutely. And I think that's the conversation that our community needs to start to think about, are those options. So along with quality and the workforce, and then the workforce that those teachers are supporting, it's also how do we deliver that in a way that it doesn't change the cost of infant toddler care in our region?
Katie, jump back in here.
Yeah, so I would completely agree. I think, you know, when you think about mixed delivery, it's both the fact that you need those 3 and 4 year olds in programs to be financially viable, but the vast majority of families need childcare beyond just the school day and the academic year. And so for most families, having that community-based provider where the child may be technically in pre-K for 6 hours a day, but then can stay for another 3 or 4 hours without having to make a transition to an after-school program or a different provider, is really beneficial.
Because most parent work days, even if they are working like kind of the standard hours, it's going to go beyond 6 hours.
Right.
Right. Okay. Glad we agree about that. I mean, are there people talking about even more radical kinds of changes than this? I am sort of curious, Katie, about how different cultures in different countries do this maybe differently altogether.
Yeah, you know, if you look at Scandinavia or Western Europe, they just have very different systems. First of all, parents usually get a lot more paid leave than they do here. So the first year or even 2 years could be covered by parental leave, kind of stacked on top of each other if you have two parents. But they also have public funding for early childhood programs that start at 2 or 3 and that are pretty universal and kind of embraced culturally as well. So it's a very different system. If you look at Quebec, they kind of started more in a place the U.S. was or is now, where families are really struggling, and they have a universal subsidized childcare program where parents pay, I think, you know, a very small portion of their income to get universal childcare. So there are a lot of models out there. We just have to kind of have the political will and the commitment to doing it.
Katie, I mean, excuse me, Giovanna, thinking about locally, I had asked you before what had changed in the years you've been watching the access to child care question unfold, and that you said not a lot had changed. I wonder if the conversation has changed, if there's been any kind of cultural change, because the receptivity to some of the things Katie just described, that would require some cultural change.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that I appreciated the most when the whole pre-K initiative was being discussed is that whenever I talked to anybody, I never had to defend the value of the early years. Previously, I would say even just 3 years ago, that would be about 50%, if not 70% of my conversation about talking about why the early years are so important. And so there's been this shift of understanding. I think the brain research has come to front.
Yeah, like that. Really little kids aren't just like bundles of bodily functions.
Absolutely. You know, when my son was young, and he was 18 months and we were having a conversation, and a gentleman came up to me and said, "You're talking to him like he's a little person." I'm like, "Well, he is." And because of that serve return. But I think it's some of those pieces. We still have a little ways to go. But I think we also are getting close to that understanding of why it's so important. And that's a highlight of the whole process.
Giovanna Ross with us from the Mid-America Regional Council. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Katie Hamm, thanks for joining us from the Center for American Progress.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, a Kansas City musician with a new idea about exploring different sides of one person in song. Stay with us. Allison Gleisman is a local musician with a complicated story to tell, and Allison's band, Mess, has a new album out. The album is a way of working through some stuff, and I would explain more, but I want Allison to do that. Allison, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. You are the singer on this album, but you sing as two characters. They're both you. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so whenever I had the idea for the record, the idea is that it follows these two people. One of them has been affected by trauma in their childhood, and these two people are in a relationship kind of post all of that trauma, and it's all unresolved, and kind of how that unresolved trauma can affect your relationships moving forward, your issues with intimacy and things like that. And so I knew that I wanted to use that perspective, but also the perspective of the other person who was trying to understand but just couldn't quite meet them in the same place. And so I thought both stories, both sides of the same story were important to be told. So, yeah, it kind of ends up being this back and forth dialogue.
In all your voice.
Right.
Do you adjust your vocal stylings for these two characters?
That was something that I just don't think I have the talent to do that. So, no, but
We're going to hear your talent in a moment. Okay. I think the listeners will probably be kinder than you were just to yourself. Okay. Go on.
Well, yeah. So it's all my voice. And that's why the storytelling, the lyrics and the mood shifts were so important, was we wanted the story to be heard the way that it was being told. And so that's why there was so much pressure on the lyrics and the music, just in general, to kind of move this narrative forward.
You know, as I was listening to the songs, I was looking using audio files that, you know, I can see the sound waves. And actually, I could visually see when it was about to change character because the music does change a lot.
Yes.
And it was interesting to look at it and be like, oh, I can see the change coming because the sound is about to get bigger, like quickly, suddenly.
Right. That's interesting.
The album is called Learning How to Talk. What does that mean?
So Learning How to Talk is a lyric from the second song, Dead Space. Whenever I wrote that lyric, I was like, wow, that really encapsulates the concept of kind of moving forward past things that have happened to you and kind of unlearning habits and unlearning things that have been taught to you that you don't deserve and you deserve better than. And so kind of, you know, meeting other people and even just using your own introspection to learn healthier habits and healthier ways to treat yourself and to treat the people that you're in relationships with.
I'd like to just ask you about the gender identity piece of that, because Hear Queer gave this album a really resoundingly positive review for the way it charts a course for finding peace in toxic relationships and, quote, constructing identity on the verge of adulthood. Can you talk about what that means to you?
Yes. Yeah, so gender to me, has both a lot of weight and no weight in my life. It's something I think about a lot, but the way that I express gender and the way that I think about gender is almost arbitrary to me. And so whenever I was forming these characters and thinking about them, it was cool how far I got before I was even forced to think, do these people have genders? Who are these people? What do they look like? And whenever I was presented with that question, I was like, I really never thought of it, because these feelings that these people are having are genderless. And so anybody can feel the way that either of these people feel. And I think that...
Do you get that question a lot? What gender are these two people?
I think I've only gotten it a couple times, especially like when I was forming it. Kevin, the bassist and guitarist in the band, is very helpful to me as a resource to just kind of talk through ideas. And he is very smart. So he forces me to think about things that I wouldn't think about. And so whenever I was, he asked me that, he was the first person. And I was like, I guess I never really thought about it. And I guess it still doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah. But let's listen to a song from very early in the album, because the album is this journey through a relationship. This song is Dead Space, and it's from the album Learning How to Talk from the band Myth.
Thank you.
What did we just hear? What's in the story of this album? What did we just hear?
So Dead Space comes, it's the first song that kind of dives in. The first song on the record is just sort of like this introduction, and then Dead Space is the second song. And it's kind of mapping out, kind of setting the stage of this first character and them talking through their experience, their traumatic experience, and kind of almost explaining that to themselves, and kind of weeding through those feelings, and very preliminary stages of them kind of coming to terms and then being ready to move forward.
And then, so that's an introduction to kind to the person who has experienced trauma.
Correct.
And carries trauma. Is that something that you wanted to explore for personal reasons?
It's kind of funny how it came to be, because I don't think that even when I was writing those lyrics that I was consciously, this was before the concept was even started. The concept came from this idea. And so whenever I was writing these lyrics, I was like, maybe this is something that I do need to confront and think about, because trauma has all different kinds of, it doesn't look the same way on everybody. And if I'm writing these things, it's probably for a reason.
Did you understand one of these two characters better than the other going into it?
It's interesting because I thought that I was definitely one person. And then as I was exploring the other side, I realized that both of these people were me, but neither of them were me at the same time. I'd been both.
The album moves toward an increasing sense of clarity and sense of self. I want to play the very end of the very last song on the album. This song is called Whole Again, and we're going to hear it now.
And it starts out brighter than it ever had, but the stars still burn out.
So this song, you know, the album is a journey, and where have you arrived at this point?
As far as the music and the concept, I'm in this stage of post-writing this record, and just looking back and being genuinely proud of that it was a long journey of writing it and kind of figuring out how it was going to be best conceived. And so coming to the end of that and realizing that it is the way that I want it to be, and it is the way that I think the best that it could is very rewarding.
You know, your voice, we've talked about that you use your voice to portray two different characters, and in that sense to be two voices. But there is a really ethereal quality to your voice, and sort of like a very clear sound. You know what I mean? Is that, can you talk to me about just your voice and developing it and your journey with your literal voice? Because we've talked about kind of figurative voices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So growing up, I've always been into singing. I've always I've always been interested in it. And so when I was in school, I would sing or whatever. And I had a lot of technical experience as far as like being a young person and learning how to breathe and how you're technically supposed to sing. The further that I got away from that, actually, I feel that I was able to find what my voice was actually supposed to sound like, kind of knowing those things and then being like, okay, that's how I'm supposed to sound, and how do I want to sound, and how can I use this to further a story, is really how I came to what my voice sounds like now.
I love it because so many of us like talk about finding our voice in this abstract way, and you really like went to find your voice.
Right.
I love it. Allison Gleisman of the band Mess, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Mess is putting on a show at the Rhino in Northtown, KC on April 28th. If you're interested, that's a wrap. You can listen back to anything we talked about today at kcur.org/centralstandard. We'll have it ready for you by the end of the day. Our earlier conversation was about childcare deserts in our community. 816 kcur.org/centralstandard. The phone number will not help you access that. Tomorrow, we will discuss the unionization of graduate workers at universities, and we'll hear from a construction worker poet in Kansas City. This show is produced by Melody Rao with Chris Young, Coy Duggar, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Salisa Kalakal. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date's next.